Welcome to Paint Ed. PCA provides painting contractors with connections they need to grow their business. To find out more and to become a member, visit pcapainted.org. Find more great content like this on PCA Overdrive. A subscription to the platform is included with membership. For all of you non-members out there, sign up for a free trial. PCA Overdrive is available on the App Store and Google Play.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Contractor Evolution. My guest on the show today is Cameron Harold. He's the best-selling author of 6 books, many of them you'll know and love, The Miracle Morning, Meetings Suck, and his most popular, Vivid Vision, just to name a few. And today, we discuss his newest book, The Second in Command, Unleash the Power of Your COO, which I am immediately putting on the must-read list for all of you. The Second in Command is an amalgamation of Cameron's wisdom through the decades of filling, studying, and writing about the COO role. He himself was the COO of 1-800-GOT-JUNK and helped Brian Scudamore scale up from $2 million a year to over $100 million a year. He hosts a podcast called the Second in Command Podcast, where he interviews COOs of some of the biggest brands in the world, Shopify, Zendesk, Asana, MailChimp, the list goes on. And he's actually even built a mastermind group for COOs called the COO Alliance, which is like Breakthrough Academy, but just for COOs. It's super cool. Anyway, today's conversation is about how you in your business can recruit, onboard, and lead a COO, a true second in command, to help you drive and build that vivid vision inside your head. So let's dive in with Cameron Harold.
You're watching Contractor Evolution, where we unpack the systems, tactics, and skills you need to take your fast-growing contracting business to the next level.
You're here to learn what it takes to scale up, work less, and increase profitability. You've come to the right place.
Stay tuned to learn what separates the new breed of contractor from the old school, and welcome to your ultimate guide on the business of contracting.
Cameron Harold, welcome to Contractor Evolution. Thank you so much for doing this all the way from Japan, mind you.
Haha. Yeah, well, we're in Tokyo right now, loving it.
Yeah, cool. I really appreciate you doing this with us, brother. I'll start with an easy one. You're a busy guy, lots on the go. Writing a book is time consumptive and intense. Why'd you decide to write it?
Why did I decide to write 6? That's the crazy question. This was my 6th book, and it was written for probably one core particular reason. There's really not a lot out there in terms of how to actually go out and recruit and find and onboard and build an amazing relationship with a second in command. And I'd played the second in command role a couple of different times. Notably, I was the COO for 1-800-GOT-JUNK, growing them from 14 employees to 3,100 employees in 6 years. I've been paid to speak all over the world about that story, and no one's ever talked about how do you go find a Cameron. And I wanted to write that book to give entrepreneurial companies a chance to actually properly scale, because most entrepreneurs struggle with the operation side of things, and there's really not a lot of good content out there for where do you find that great second in command.
Yeah, awesome. I don't like
writing books though, Benji.
What's that? You like writing books?
No, I don't like writing books. It's tough, man. It's a hard process.
Is it hard? Okay, here's a good question. Is it, from the outside looking in, is it harder or easier than it looks?
It's way harder. Well, it's way harder to write a great book. It's easy to write a book and get it out the door.
Right.
You know, you could leverage AI, you can get a ghostwriter, you can put some shit out, you could have it published and out the door, but it'll be littered with spelling mistakes and grammar, and the pre-press won't look very good, and the content will be kind of schlocky, and it'll really miss the point. This book has really taken off, and as I've, I'd say 4 or 5 of my 6 books are really, really, really good, because I really gave a shit. Like, I really worked really hard at getting good content. But to really get the good content, to really make sure that you take a lot of good expert ideas and package it in without just pulling 30 interviews and calling it a book, yeah, it's tough to write a great book.
I hate those books, dude. I get sent them all the time. Weak. And I get sent them all the time. Yeah. I'm like, this isn't a book, dude. You took some transcripts from some Zoom calls, and you hired a graphic designer for a cover, and give me a break. I hear you. So
yeah,
listen, I want you to define you know, the Cameron Herald definition of the COO role. And then while you're doing it, if you can maybe comment on anything that people commonly misunderstand or get wrong about this all important position.
Yeah. And it's even why I called my book The Second in Command instead of the COO. I think a lot of companies have missed a huge opportunity. And what they're doing is they're giving away big titles too early to people that don't have the actual roles and responsibility, the level of strategic insight, the level of P&L responsibility, the level of autonomy to deserve a role that's that high, nor are they paying them a compensation that matches that title of a COO. So the true COO should really be able to come in and run your business for you. They don't need to be managed. They can manage the financials. They can build out the team. They understand strategy. They could really almost let you go off and just work on culture and vision. But what most companies have done is they've got a director of operations or a VP of operations, and they're giving them a title that's too big. So that's why I called the book The Second in Command, is it's trying to help entrepreneurial and mid-sized companies to find that true yin and yang partner to the CEO.
The comment about titles is very interesting. You said they're not paying them like a CEO. You're not paying them like a CEO yet until this guy goes and does a couple Google searches on what a COO makes and comes back to you and says, hey, it actually turns out that this position is worth $400K a year. When in reality, you've got a director of operations. You gave them the COO title because it sounds good and it looks good on a business card. And now you're really screwed because you have an inexperienced person who's actually not at that level demanding more money. So that's a real mistake I think people can avoid.
And you know what? And so 20 years ago, to get a C-level title, whether you're going to be a COO or a chief marketing officer or a chief financial officer or a chief technology officer, 20 years ago to get one of those titles, you had to be a major player at a major company and you were making major compensation. When I left 1-800-GOT-JUNK 17 years ago as their COO, my comp 17 years ago was $316,000. So in today's dollars, that's probably about $550,000. Mm-hmm. That's a true COO. But we also had 3,000 people, and we scaled to 106 million. We were a real business with real moving parts. What's happened now is we've got this title inflation. And to your point, I think companies are giving away that title too early, and they're doing it across all the different functional areas. So be very, very cautious with that.
Title inflation. That's a really interesting comment. We could do a whole other podcast on that. One of the things. So, just to recap, you kind of title it The Second in Command, I think, to maybe give a little bit more flex or a little bit more lateral movement to this idea of installing someone to support the CEO, to support the visionary, and whether they're called a bona fide COO at a true enterprise level firm, or maybe it's a director of operations, or maybe it's something else entirely. I get that. And I think that's actually a really important thing to highlight here at the beginning. Now, one of the things that really jumped off the page to me in the early section of the book was this. You said most COOs, as qualified as they are, as talented as they are, would actually do a terrible job running 90% of other companies. And I want you to unpack why that is for us.
Yeah, great, great point. I'm glad you found that point in the book too. So I've run an organization for the last 6.5 years called the COO Alliance, and we have members that are second in commands from 17 countries that are members of our mastermind community. They're all running companies at least 5 million or greater. Some of those COOs run finance, some don't. Some run IT, some don't. Some run engineering, some don't. Some run marketing, some don't. The COO has to run all of the areas that the CEO sucks at. And they have to match the behavioral traits and the kind of personality profile of that CEO. They also have to match the stage of the company that they're in. So even though I was the great COO for 1-800-GOT-JUNK, we really scaled a fantastic company, I was perfect for the season that they were in, right? Going from 2 million to 106 million, that was my zone. But now their new COO, who I've actually been friends with for 36 years, he and I started a fraternity together in Ottawa, Canada in 1987. I was president year one. He was president the second year. He's now their COO and has been for the last 10 years. He would have been a horrible COO for the first 6 years because he wasn't entrepreneurial and he didn't know how to scale and build out a franchise company. but he's been amazing to take them from 100 million to 500 million. Mm-hmm. So he's in the right season with the right skill set, matching the DNA of that entrepreneur, but a very different skill set to me. I would have been massively incompetent to take the company from 100 million to 500 million, even though I matched the CEO. So it's all about matching the skill set, the behavioral traits, and the stage that that organization is in. So as an example, for me to go in, just because I was great at the 1-800-GOT-JUNK phase, I would be horrible to go in and be the COO of Shopify, because Shopify is this big corporate engineering. Harley Finkelstein, he and I have been friends since they had 50 employees. He's the CEO of Shopify. Would have been horrible at 1-800-GOT-JUNK. Mm-hmm. Now, he might have been able to pull it off, but again, he didn't have the skill set or the industry, or he probably didn't match the DNA that Brian had. So it's a really complicated role.
Is it the case that many business owners make the mistake of thinking that a COO is a more fixed position? In other words, they go chief operating officer. Yeah. Okay, so they're chiefing the operations. If it operates, they chief it. What does that mean? Well, it's, I'm going to direct this, I'm going to direct that. And you can pretty quickly make a mental picture of what that might be, what that might entail, the scope, the size, the shape of their work. But what you're saying is that it's actually way more about the needs of the CEO and the visionary and then the entity of the business as well. And then laying over top the season that both of those things are in. So it is... this is a much more elastic idea than just like some basic role, job description that someone could download and iterate.
Well, and yeah, and let me give you a physical, real world example that anyone who's listening is going to understand. Let's say that you're a guy and you want to get married. You don't go out and go, oh, you're a woman who's been married before. You've been a wife. You can be my wife now.
Right.
No, like you don't know if you and she sync, like, do you want to have kids and she doesn't? Do you want to live in a certain area and she doesn't? Do you, are you like a hard driving, you know, male and she's more like, you need to make sure that you're in sync with that person. Just because she's been a wife before doesn't mean she's going to be a good wife for you.
Right.
And that's very similar. And I see it all the time where an entrepreneur will be like, oh, I'm looking for a COO who has a job description that I can borrow.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I mean.
That job description is for a very different human than what, even though it's the same title. You need to understand yourself and your company and the stage of business and describe that role. Very different, though, if you're hiring a head of marketing. The head of marketing for most companies could be the head of marketing for another company. The head of finance for most companies could be the head of finance, because it's a functional role that isn't as tightly integrated with the CEO as that yin and yang partner.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such an important point. Okay. For our listeners, we were talking offline, I was saying like most of our listeners would be business owners between 1 and 10 million a year. Some would be smaller, some would be even bigger. But it is, you know, what you would archetypally think of as a blue collar business. And you come from, you know, you come from the junk removal space. You know how these businesses operate.
Dude, I come from way more blue collar than junk removal. My first company, when I was 20 years old, I had 12 employees and we painted houses.
Yeah.
I ended up building out 220 employees painting houses. I did painted houses for 7 years. Then I did auto body. Then I did junk removal. So
you get it.
I was blue collar.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for those types of businesses, can you give us a sense for what size or what stage a COO or a second in command really starts to make sense?
Yeah, I'm glad you're asking this question. So the only reason that you start a company is for one of three reasons: either to give you money, to give you free time, or to actually kind of put a stake in the ground or a flag in the ground to say that you accomplished something, to give you a feeling of accomplishment. Well, once you've got your business up and running, you've got that feeling, okay, I'm a business owner, now what? And once you've got enough cash coming in, a couple hundred grand, 500 grand, whatever, you're making enough cash, more cash would be nice, but it's not what it's for. So at a certain point, hiring the second in command is to give you back your time, right? To allow you to have a relationship with yourself, to have some hobbies, to go on some ski trips, to spend time with your kids, to spend time with friends, and to work on the areas of the business that fulfill you, that fire you up, you know, to work in your area of unique ability or your area of genius. I always talk about delegating everything except genius. So the time that I think most people want to hire that second in command is when they feel like they're drowning in a lot of stuff that drains them of energy, that just isn't fun, and they just don't have enough time to do cool stuff. When we were 15 years old, we would wait an hour to take a bus to save $15. But as an adult, I'll spend 15 bucks all day long to take an Uber somewhere to save 30 minutes or save 5 minutes. So you get to a certain point where you use your money to buy back your time, as Dan Martell talks about in his book, to give you. So that's one reason you're hiring that second in command, is to buy back your time. The second is so that you get to work on the cool shit that feeds you, right? Mm. You get to delegate all the stuff that drains you of energy. That's number two. The third reason is to allow you to scale and multiply, because 1 + 1 = 7, right? Mm. When you hire a good COO who loves to work on all the areas that drain you, everything goes. And when you as the entrepreneur show up as the chief energizing officer, getting to work on all the cool, fun stuff, and you're filled with energy and you're only working on the stuff that makes you feel good, all that positive energy spills over into the rest of your company and it fuels up your business. But here's a little side note that I want everyone to think about. If you don't have an executive assistant yet, you are one. So before you hire a director of operations or an operations manager or a VP of operations, hire an executive assistant or a fractional executive assistant to get all the minimum wage jobs off your plate. Because if you're doing any tasks on a daily basis or weekly basis that are $15 an hour tasks, $20 an hour tasks, I would fire you as the CEO. If I was your board and I found out I was paying you 300 grand a year to do a $15 an hour task, I'd lose my mind. Mm-hmm. So the first key hire that you want as your second in command is an executive assistant to get all the admin off your plate so that now you're working on at least the higher value parts of your business.
I love that comment. We just had Dan Martell on a few weeks ago, and I asked him about the executive assistant piece, because there's a whole chapter dedicated to it. And I'm boring my listeners because I've said this on other episodes, but it bears repeating. He is so bullish on getting an executive assistant as early as possible that he said, go borrow the money if you have to. It's literally the only, it's the only investment that is an absolute guarantee on ROI. And he can't believe more business owners don't do it sooner.
I agree. And by the way, Dan and I are proof of why it makes sense to be in a mastermind community like the one you run. Dan and I are both members of a couple of mastermind communities together where we sit together to learn from other entrepreneurs, where we're in the room learning. We're not the smartest person in the room. We're there to learn with all these other entrepreneurs. And his COO, Matt Verlacky, is a member of our COO Alliance. So he's even trying to grow his people to help him grow the company. So yeah, we're very much on this. We've been friends for 11 or 12 years now.
Cool. That's awesome. Okay. I want to get into like how to find one, how to onboard one, how to work together successfully for the long term. There's a bunch of stuff we want to get into here. Before we do, we got to talk wardrobe, Cameron. We got to talk wardrobe here. So, okay. I've been saying this for a couple of weeks now on the podcast. We're doing things differently this year because I've run out of t-shirts, and we're going to feature our members' businesses on every episode. So everyone, wardrobe today is brought to you by Gables and Grove. This is owned and operated by Andrew Kazana in Miami, Florida. Okay, he's a painting contractor, does interior, exterior, residential, commercial. Your kind of typical service offering for a painting contractor. Member with Breakthrough Academy for 2 years. He's starting his third. He works with Coach Harold. They just did a rebrand. I really like this stuff. I've got a hat. I'm not wearing the jacket because it's too warm in here, but he sent me home with a windbreaker too. We're going to put that on screen here. And so he works with Coach Harold. Big challenge that he's trying to get over this year. It's a really hyper-focused lead gen year for Andrew. 582 leads is the critical number for their business, and that's spread across. It's spread across residential, commercial, drywall, etc. And then a big win. This is cool, and you might this kind of ties into what we were saying a second ago, just in terms of delegation. So, big win for Gables and Grove this year, improving production efficiency and AR specifically on the commercial side of his business. What he said was he leaned on Breakthrough Academy members in his mastermind group to figure out payment terms and how to structure the contract to reduce that AR thing. And then the other big win, I love this, he's just very recently figured out the whole VA thing, and he's hired VAs for both the sales side and the production side. He says it's an absolute game changer. So huge shout out to Andrew, shout out to Meg too. His partner, she actually did the design, the rebrand. I'll turn around. You can see the logo. Very cool. So
nice.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks guys. Really appreciate the gear. There you have it. There's wardrobe thoughts.
Yeah. Well, don't please. As much as I love the shirt, please don't send one to me, because my wife and I have been traveling full time for 2.5 years and we only have a couple of small little backpacks. So love the gear, but let's keep sending that to Benji, because I can't travel with any more gear. But I'll give him one idea that could really help his company, and that's to remember that your employees have most of the answers for you on what's going to help you scale the company. And even if they don't have the right answer, asking them for ideas on how to solve some of your problems or how to solve some of your big wins. So if you're looking for 582 new leads, yep. Sit down with your employees and say, hey, if this was our goal, what do you guys think we should do to get us there? And by the CEO speaking last, by the CEO giving his ideas last or her ideas last, and getting the ideas to filter up from the bottom and then getting the team to vote on their favorite ideas, you're going to have a lot more buy-in, a lot more excitement around it. And you'd be amazed at the ideas that'll come from the frontline staff that will trickle up. And then the buy-in from that is going to give you the momentum. And momentum creates momentum, not perfection.
I love it. If you are listening and you want to work with like 600 other members like Andrew, you want to work with a coach like Coach Harold, you want to grow your business and systemize it properly, you got to check out Breakthrough Academy. We're pretty easy to find. We'll maybe put something on screen here that you can click on. Anyway, listen, let's dive in. I want to talk about sort of this finding a COO question, Cameron. So going back to this idea before, it's all about the fit with the visionary first and foremost. How should, because there's a lot of visionaries listening, how should CEOs or visionaries first begin to understand themselves so they can even begin to conceptualize finding that other missing piece of the puzzle?
You know, it's interesting. I first learned this concept from doing some personality profiles about me and the rest of our leadership teams and a couple of companies that I'd built. Namely, starting at College Pro Painters was when I first started doing it. And then at Gerber Auto Collision in the second, we started doing personality profiles of the leadership team. And every year I did a different personality profile on me. So one year I would do DISC, the next year I would do PSI, next year I'd do, you know, Strength Finders, next year I'd do Colby. And every year that I did another personality profile about me, I learned about myself. And by sharing that information with the team, they learned about me. So that was the first starting point to understand me. The second one was a guest on our Second in Command podcast. I interviewed a guy named Matt from Rippling, and Matt's idea was to write a 2-page operating manual to himself. Now imagine if you wrote down everything about you and shared that with your team. What pisses you off? How do you like to be communicated with? How do you like to manage conflict? How do you like to be apologized to? How do you like to be asked for help? How do you like your open door policy to work? You know, how do you like memos to be written? And you told everybody as much about you so that they understood on day one how to work with you. That's another really good starting point for the CEO is to do, can they really self-examine every aspect of themselves? I think those two things are the starting point. The next part is, what are all the parts of the business that you really get drained of energy from working on? And can you build that into the functional area for someone to run for you? So as an example, if you're the CEO of Shopify, you might love engineering and finance. Those are two areas that report to Tobias Luque. But in another company, you could have a CEO who hates engineering and finance, and he wants those areas to report to the COO. Right? So it's all about understanding what parts of the business drain you and who are you in terms of your personality profiles. The last part that I would bundle in there, though, is what are the core values of your company? And these are not just things you post up on the wall. These are the core values that you're willing to fire people if they break your core values, right? These are the core values that people have to show up and live and obsess on every single day, and make sure that those are really kind of trickling throughout the job posting that you're going to be creating.
Yeah, I love that. Where are these people? Like, how do we find them? Like, this is not, I think in most instances, you know, I don't think you're posting a "we're hiring" post on Instagram and your dream COO walks into the organization. There's likely some bona fide recruitment activity behind this. So any thoughts on just like beginning the search or the pawns to start looking in?
So great employees are never out looking for a job. Great employees already have a job and they're probably working for either a great company or a pretty good company. Your job is to entice them over to your brand, which is one of the reasons why your brand needs to be strong, your company website needs to be strong, your press needs to be strong, your social media presence needs to be strong, is you're trying to attract these people into your business. Now, you're going to have a better chance finding them on Instagram than you will finding them on Craigslist or Indeed, right? None of the great employees are on a job board looking for a job. But they might be on social media or their friends might be on social media. So if you describe that person on social media, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, with your email list, on Instagram, wherever, if you describe what you're looking for in a very polarizing way, right, where you push some people away from you, but that magnetizes and it pulls others towards you. As an example, I don't love that I swear, but I swear. I mean, it comes out fairly often. I try to not use the F-bombs when I'm on a podcast, but I've actually written a job posting and I've used the F-word in a job posting. And I'll be like, oops, there's my first F-bomb. Sorry about that, but at least we get it out. And I'll have people reply to me going, I can't believe you swore in a job posting. I'd never work for you. Delete.
Right.
And I'll have other people going, oh my gosh, I effing love that you swore in your job posting. I'm like, oh, you're interesting. Who are you? Now, again, I don't love that I do it. But the fact that I write it out there and I put it out there in a polarizing way, people are like, I want to work for you. Every one of my job postings talks about me being a slightly manic, fairly bipolar, massively ADD, very driven executive or CEO coach. And people will be like, oh my God, I wouldn't want to work with anybody bipolar. Then don't apply, man, because I have 11 of the 11 traits of bipolar. Mm-hmm. But I also built the number two company to work for in Canada. So, you know, pick your dragon.
If you make any headway on the swearing thing, I would love some notes. It's unbelievably difficult to filter out. I've actually asked here's the solution, because I'm not going to stop. I've had our video producer, who's right over there, I'm looking at him. He now goes through and just bleeps everything, because we've had enough people. Right. We've had enough YouTube comments being like,
Descript's amazing.
Descript's amazing. Okay, so. Assuming you find this person and they're a rock star and everything's feeling good. I'm skipping a step. I was going to get into onboarding. Let me just maybe go one step further down. Let's talk about that interviewing process, that courtship. Is there any insight you can lay out for our members when they've got someone on the hook, they've got a nibble, and they're like, oh, you know, this man or woman's pretty interesting. Like, what advice would you give them for really both courting and selling the position and the vision and the upside, while also making sure, like, hey, is this person the right fit?
Yeah, the only selling that your company should do of a COO candidate or a second in command candidate is your vivid vision. You should be handing them a 5-page description of what your company looks like, acts like, and feels like in the future. And if they love what's written down in that vivid vision document, that's the only selling you should do. The rest of the time in the interview, you should be asking questions and listening. You should be probing like crazy and listening. And you should tell them that they'll have lots of time at the end of the interview to ask you questions. But for the first 95% of the interview, it's your time to ask them questions. That's number one. Number two, when you're hiring that second in command to come into your company, get a bunch of your management team to interview that person too, right? Get your head of finance, your head of marketing, your head of IT, get like a couple of other regional managers, whoever, to start interviewing the second in command candidate. Don't let it just be you. Number three is see if you can get a couple of advisors, some board members, some other mastermind members to do some 30-minute interviews of this candidate as well, to really see if they're going to be able to work with someone like you, right? They don't necessarily have to ask the functional questions, but they can really probe in around the culture side of things to see if that person's going to be able to work with you. And then lastly, I would even read a book called Who by Jeff Smart, and I would follow the TORC process. I talk about it in my Invest in Your Leaders course and also in my book, Double Double. but follow the threat of reference check process to really probe in around who this candidate really is.
Okay. Love that. Okay. Let's move on to onboarding. General best practices here. Let's try to speak to this in terms of like a, let's just say like a $10 million a year construction company like that. Let's picture the shape of that org chart,
sure,
that environment. How do we do this well? Because there was another line in the book that I really loved. You said it's like dropping a boulder being dropped in a pond, and there's ripples and there's splashes. And that's a really compelling visual for this whole idea. So maybe just talk first about the impact. Like why do you use the boulder in a pond analogy to describe it first of all, and then we can get to best practices.
I remember this as a kid. I don't know how old I was. I was probably like 7 years old. I remember taking what was a boulder to me. It was probably, you know, the size of a football. And I dropped it into a pond, and the whole point was to drop it into the pond to watch it sink to the bottom. And it did. The boulder got to the bottom of the pond really quickly. It did exactly what it was supposed to. And then all these ripples started to happen on the pond, and I was watching the ripples, and I thought, those are really interesting. What happens when you hire a senior person, they're going to be successful. They're going to get the job done. They're going to get to the bottom of the pond quite quickly, but there's going to be ripples that are going to happen inside of your company. There's going to be good ripple effects and bad ripple effects. There's going to be stuff that your customers notice that they love and that your customers don't love. There's going to be changes in the company that some of your employees like and some of them don't like. There's going to be a couple of employees that wanted that COO job and they didn't get it. And now they get to report to this new person. Those are some bad ripple effects. There's going to be communication differences that happen. There's going to be new meeting rhythms that happen. Those are different ripple effects. Your job as the CEO is to watch for those ripple effects as they happen and not only worry about making this person successful, but also worry and watch for those ripple effects as well.
Mm-hmm. And so when watching the ripples and trying to, because you say there's good and bad ripples, so maybe you're trying to reduce the impact of those negative ripples. Is there anything in terms of, you know, a 30, 60, 90 day check-in in terms of processes to follow, in terms of, I don't know, a certain meeting cadence to get into? Like, what have you found effective for CEOs or visionaries to ensure the highest percentage likelihood of the COO's effectiveness and success long-term, first of all, and then hopefully reduce the impact of those negative ripples where possible?
Yeah. I'll give you a really good 90 day plan for how anyone should bring a solid COO or a very senior person into the company. So let's say you're hiring a VP of operations as your second in command. The first 30-day period into, let's say, your $10 million construction company, that VP of operations should go and meet with every director and every manager and every other VP. They should have lunch with them. They should have coffee with them. They should ask questions to understand that person's area. They should go and attend every different business area's meetings. They should sit in on a couple of finance meetings, sit in on a couple of marketing meetings, sit in a couple of operations meetings. They should listen to 10 different phone calls with customers. They should go out and do 10 different sales calls with a couple of different salespeople. They should go out and, you know, go to the different construction sites. They should literally read every page of your website. They should read all of the marketing manuals. They should read all of your policy documents. They should read any of your internal wiki documents. And for 30 days, their job is to understand the business. And they should also, during that 30 days, have a little notebook and write down all the things they want to change, all of the ideas that they have for the company. And they should not work on any of those ideas. They should just make a list. So let's say after the first 30 days, they've met with everybody, they've sat in all the meetings, they have 60 ideas that they want to put in place. Month two, they spend time going back and talking to people about their 60 different ideas to understand them, to test their hypotheses. Maybe one of their ideas was, oh, we need to fire Bob. Well, now after talking to four or five people in month two, they realize, no, we need to promote Bob. We need to fire Kelly. Or we need to integrate this new marketing software. But after talking to three or four people, they realize, no, we don't need that marketing software. We just need to actually improve using AI and this one marketing tool that we're using. So in month two, they're going to test their hypotheses and they're going to start to rank all the projects that they'd like to work on. In month three, they should start putting in place some of the projects that are easiest to work on, the low-hanging fruit, the things that you could do as a company that require very little time, very little people, and very little money that are going to give you some kind of a return. And ideally, like launching a satellite, it takes a little bit of effort to get it into orbit, and it pays dividends for years. If you can put a bunch of projects in place in the third quarter that have a low pain in the ass factor, a low PETA factor, and they pay dividends, all of the employers are going to be like, wow, this person is really smart. We just did these seven ideas of theirs. They weren't hard. They didn't take up any time. They didn't take up any money. And look at the dividends they're already paying. That gives you the permission in the second quarter to start working on some of the bigger, hairier projects. It allows you in the second quarter to start firing people and start hiring people. But if you do that stuff too early, the ripple effects are too big.
Is that term the PETA factor? Is that something that you use in your businesses? I've never heard of that.
Yeah, So when we were building College Pro Painters, which went on to become the largest house painting company in the world, we had acronyms for everything. And I don't remember whether it was mine or one of my, like a teammate or somebody, but somehow it's from back in those College Pro Painters days, 30 odd years ago, the PETA factor.
Pain in the ass. That's a good, good acronym. I'm going to save that. Talk to me more about why so the central idea of that blurb that you just went through, the 30, 60, 90, the most sort of fundamental thing that shines through there is observation and presence, like really just being there, taking in what's going on. Can you maybe, maybe it seems obvious to some listeners, but I often find there's kind of profound points when you dig a layer deeper. What happens if you skip that step?
Here's the big thing is most entrepreneurs are so relieved and so happy to have that second command on board finally that they want them to just go and start. That's too early. They don't understand the freaking business at all yet. They don't know the history. They don't know the culture. They don't know the people. Right. And if you give them too much responsibility too quickly, or you let them make a lot of big decisions too quickly, they're going to cause way too many ripple effects. You need to slow it down so that they understand, right? Mm. You need to give them the base, kind of the base of the pyramid. It's like building a home. If you're in construction and all you want to do is quickly put in the Sub-Zero fridge and the Wolf stove and the beautiful cabinets, you're going to have a really shaky home. Yeah. It takes months to get the foundation ready. It takes months to put up the walls and the framing. It takes months to put in the electrical and the plumbing. And too many entrepreneurs are going to say, oh, I'm so glad you're here. Start.
Right.
That's like putting in the Wolf stove before you've even poured the foundation.
So
you can do it, but it's going to be stupid.
You do want to give them as much time as possible to just learn the layers of the business and understand the complexity, the people, the process, the vision, all that stuff, rather than loading too fast. Here's kind of a fun one. Maybe you just answered one of these three, but one of the questions I had for you about onboarding is, if you could share with me three, and maybe this comes from the COO Alliance, maybe it comes from your podcast or your own lived experience. What are three things that CEOs often do that drive COOs absolutely mental?
Well, okay, this is a great question. What's one thing that a husband does that drives the wife crazy? Well, there's a laundry list of everything, right? We don't give them enough time to express themselves, right? We try to solve their problems for them. We meddle in parts of the business or parts of the home that is really their that the area that they like, right? We f*** everything up. Very similar to the CEO. CEOs usually like to move really quickly. COOs like to ask a lot of questions and put a system in place before they start something. If the CEO moves too quickly, it drives the COO crazy. COOs like to ask a lot of questions. If the CEO shuts them down or gets frustrated with those questions, that's going to drive them crazy. Remember, when you're an entrepreneur and you want to delegate a project to somebody, you've been thinking about that project for a couple of weeks or for a few hours or for at least 20 or 30 minutes. How can you expect your second in command to understand the idea in 4 seconds? Mm. You need to allow them to ask you 7 or 8 questions without thinking they're debating you. The other thing that a husband does that drives a wife crazy is they don't have date night. They don't spend enough time working on the relationship and having fun. And they spend all their time focusing on work or focusing on something instead of focusing on the relationship. CEOs need to spend time having date night with their COO, getting out of the office and away from the rest of the kids, having a good time together, hanging out and building that relationship so that you can work through the conflict areas together. You can work through the hard times together.
I love that. I see how kind of accurate and explicit that the parallel is between those two sort of styles of relationship. When you're looking at long-term successful CEO, COO, entrepreneur, second in command, visionary integrator, however you want to, whatever terminology you want to use, when you're looking at these successful duos over the long term, are there like set rituals and systems that you can point to that really help maintain that relationship for years or even decades?
Yeah, there is, for sure there is, you know, and again, it is like a husband and wife relationship, or, you know, a non-traditional relationship of two people that are in a relationship together. It's spending time working on the relationship. It's spending time working on the communication. You know, the famous book from 30 years ago was Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. The book, The Second in Command, is kind of the business book like that. It's teaching you how to have a good communication with this person who has a very different personality profile to you. So it's about working on those skills. Back when Brian and I were building 1-800-GOT-JUNK, in the first couple of months we were building the company 22 years ago, we hired a relationship coach who used to work with married couples to come in and work with us on our relationship inside of the business. And he had been my best man at my wedding 3 months before that. We'd been best friends for 4.5 years, but that was outside of the business world. Inside of the company, we had to learn how to have a good relationship as a business couple. So we worked with a marriage coach on that stuff. And I think that CEOs and COOs can work with those kinds of people to help you navigate the communication differences, the personality profile differences, to establish a solid baseline of trust. The business stuff gets layered on top of that.
What was that like doing marriage counseling with Brian?
It was great. Joan Morrow is the woman's name. She's a fantastic, she works with EO and YPOers all over the world. She was incredible. We also started doing, that's when we started doing personality profiles and bringing those into the company. I'd done a lot of them with College Pro Painters and with Gerber Auto Collision. I introduced personality profiles to 1-800-GOT-JUNK, and those were very powerful because we realized it wasn't about changing the other person. It was about understanding the other person so that you could truly leverage that person's strengths and work around their weaknesses. But you're not going to change the other person. But if you understand them, then you can really work well in a collaborative way.
I got a few directions I could go in here. I guess I'll ask you this one. I have always wondered, and I've always felt on some level like CEOs kind of get all the glory. I'd actually go a step further and say I think that the term visionaries become highly overrated and used way too liberally. I'm a visionary. Yeah. It's a $2 million painting company. How much vision do you need? Like, calm down. So I think like,
right.
It's
not a pedestal term.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Like, a visionary should not be a pedestal term, right? I think too many people are calling themselves a visionary and everyone else is secondary to that. That's not what it's about. It's a having and articulating a vision is a responsibility. It's not a title above others. Right. It's why the logo on my book is the yin and yang. It's that true partnership. It's like a husband and wife. Neither of those are above the others inside of the company. They're a partner. They're a team, right? And they're building the family unit together. So I think that CEOs have to remember that, like, the COO's job is to make the CEO look good, to make the CEO iconic, to make the CEO kind of the beacon, to make the CEO the chief energizing officer. So we have to take all the tough decisions and the hard decisions off their plate. That's true. But the CEO's job is to make the COO look good, right? To shine the spotlight on the COO. It's why when Brian and I were talking to the media a lot about growing 1-800-GOT-JUNK, he always talked about me in the media. He's talked about me in all of his books. He brought me on stages to do speaking events around the company to build my profile as that second in command, because internally I was having to be the bad. I was having to say no. I was having to make all the tough decisions. And he didn't want to just be this iconic figure with Cameron being the So he made me look good while I made him look good, and it became very circular.
Well, I love what you've just said, and I feel validated because I've sort of quietly been thinking this, and I feel like very like judgmental or cynical when I say it, but I'm like, books get popular and people listen to podcasts and the whole thoughtosphere goes round and round, and then terms like visionary and integrator become popular and people are very quick to give themselves the visionary badge. Because it sounds good, like because it makes them feel cool or whatever. And it's always bugged me. I'm like, dude, like ideas are the easy part, man. Like, and really like what you're saying is you just want to sit around and do whiteboarding sessions and meditate and work with business gurus. And like, it's like, you know, the best bit of all time, which is circulating on LinkedIn recently, I've seen it a bunch lately, is Steve Jobs, who talks about this whole idea of like, there's such an incredible amount of craftsmanship between a good idea and a finished product. And I think that that really speaks to the whole idea well. And right now in this decade, in this certain kind of like pocket that we're in, I found this whole visionary thing getting a little too popular and people using it.
Yeah.
It's too grandiose. It's just like, calm down and let's have some respect for the second in command, for the rest of the team that they lead, who, by the way, are getting all the done.
Well, let me give you another strength of entrepreneurs. And by the way, so the term visionary and integrator were popularized by Gino Wickman in his book, Traction,
his second book,
Rocket Fuel. Gino and I have sat beside each other a number of times. We're both members of three different mastermind communities together. I know him well. I have some very strong differences with a couple of his things. And his stuff is really meant for the 10 to 50 person companies. My work is really meant for the 50 to 500 person companies. Two big differences that he doesn't talk about in his books, and I really think he should. One of the biggest strengths of entrepreneurs is their ADD. The fact that entrepreneurs have attention deficit disorder is not a weakness. It's a massive strength. It allows them to see everything that's happening in the company. They notice the little things. They see the problems. They see the opportunities. They notice what's happening with trends. They see the problems on the website. They notice metrics jumping off the dashboard. But they're so overwhelmed with all this stuff because they're seeing it everywhere. They need to pass it to somebody who can make it all work. And that's the COO who can organize all that chaos. So if entrepreneurs could recognize it's not just about being a visionary, it's also about being able to notice all this stuff and deliver it to someone who can make that stuff happen for you. That's a big strength. Second area that they do a massive disservice to companies is they're saying that the integrator or the second in command has to be the tiebreaker. Mm-hmm. Not true at all. And here's why. When you have a management team of very new people that have never really built companies, yeah, you might need a second in command to be the tiebreaker. But when you're building a leadership team of strong functional leaders in each business area, you can't go in and go, well, I've got the power of veto. I'm making the decision. I'm breaking the tie. No, you need to get everybody to argue, everybody to debate, everybody to share ideas, everybody to share the facts, and everybody to come to consensus together. You need to be more of the mediator and the collaborator and the consensus builder and the manager of conflict to help the team make decisions together. It's very similar to mom and dad. When mom and dad tell a two-year-old, because I said so, the two-year-old listens. When mom and dad say, because it's my house, to the four-year-old listens. When you say that to a 13-year-old, the 13-year-old goes, F you, I'm out of here. You can't operate as the tiebreaker forever inside of your company, nor can you do that as a parent.
Very interesting. And to be clear, like I have read both of those books. I had Mark C. Winters on who wrote
Rocket Fuel.
Yeah. Yeah. He wrote it with Gino. So, and I'm familiar with the framework and by and large, I really like it. The thing that always bugs me is the CEOs get all the glory. And I think that there's like absolutely this team behind the scenes that are quietly making it all happen. And it's not as sexy and you don't get the PR and you don't get to do the vision boarding to the same level. And I'm just rooting for the little guy. I'm like, give these guys some credit. Cause this, you know, this whole actually doing the thing is a hell of a lot of work too.
Well, it's why, so I'd say about 30% of our CEO Alliance members use the systems in EOS, which is from the book Traction, and I'm a big fan of it. I told my sister and her company they absolutely need to use it. I use some of the systems in Traction in my business, but it breaks down when you get past about 50 yeah. employees and you need to build a real leadership team and a real business.
So there's a chapter of the book called The Party's Over, or maybe it was just a header called The Party's Over. And this going full circle, I think this ties into this idea you opened with around seasons. When do we know the party's over and what do we do about it?
The party's over is kind of when do you know that that person in that second in command role, or even really any leader in your company, when do you know that the company has now outgrown them, or that the season of that company has now outgrown the skill set of that person, or that you need someone different to take you to the next level? This happened to me back at 1-800-GOT-JUNK. You know, we replaced the head of the call center. We replaced the head of finance. We replaced the head of IT. We replaced the head of franchise sales. I was the fifth of the five leadership team members over the 6 years to finally get replaced. And Brian sat me down one morning, and I think it was May 17th in 2007. And he said, I think we're done. And I started to cry and he started to cry and I knew he was right. And he said, you know, you were the right guy to get us from 2 million to 100 million or 106 million, but you're the wrong guy to take us from the 106 million to the billion. And he was right. And the company had just gotten too big for my entrepreneurial COO skill set. And I understood that. And it was done at the right time. There's an old rule of thumb that one of my mentors, who was being groomed as the COO at Starbucks, used to say, and it's that when you have doubt, you have no doubt. And I think it's really important to realize that when your gut is telling you it's over, it's probably over.
Mm. I love that. So powerful. It's not easy though. You can have that brutal doubt for years or decades and do nothing with it. But it's been there the whole time. Oh,
it's brutal. Brian made me take a taxi home that morning, and he drove my car home for me because I was dysfunctional. I was sobbing, and so was he. And it's like, yeah, it's brutal. It's really tough. It took me probably a good 2 years to get over that. And I think it took him about the same. Well, it actually took him 2 years to really find a solid replacement for me too.
But give us the silver lining on that. I mean, like, obviously it's emotional and hard, but you've gone on to do other things. 1-800's gone on to do other things. I mean, this is a natural, almost like a, I want to say like a biological process. Like this is part of it. Like the organizations grow, the people grow in different directions or at different rates, and that's okay.
You know, I never really talk about this, but I'll use that marriage analogy, and I've never really brought this up, but my wife and I, when we had kids, you know, at the 10-year mark, we decided to get divorced, and it was the end of our season together. We'd been together for 17 years total, and we'd raised these two boys to 10 and 8 years old, and it just wasn't there, and I needed to move on in my world, and she deserved to have something different in her world, and I've moved in to become this very different person than I was, you know, this was 13 years ago. And so did she. And we're now really good friends. We get along really well. We text and talk all the time. She used to go into my home. She'd send me a text message saying, hey, I know you're out of town for a couple of weeks. I'm going to drop by your home and go through all the kids' drawers and cupboards and make sure they have what they need. She wasn't even asking me if she could. She was telling me she was going over. She's had dinners with my new wife. She's hung out with us. We just knew that that was the end of our chapter. And I think in business, you can have the end of a chapter, and it doesn't have to be done in the wrong way. It can be done in a very respectful way, because at the end of the day, none of this matters. This is just what we're doing to make money, right? We still have to be good humans, and we're all just walking each other home.
Totally. This is the video game we decided to play with the time we have here on Earth. And you're trying to score points, and you want to win the game. But at the end of the day, it's not the be all end all, and it's not the reason we're here. Dude, this has been such a great conversation. I want to let you get back to your vacation in Japan. Where can people connect with you? Where can they follow you? Where can they read your books?
Yeah, if they go to CameronHerold.com, it's H-E-R-O-L-D, they'll see all the information about my courses and my books and the Second in Command podcast, everything else. If they follow me on the Second in Command podcast, that's definitely a great space. Our YouTube channels, we have a Cameron Herold YouTube channel and the Second in Command podcast YouTube channel are both good. And we really never talked about my course, but anybody listening, check out investinyourleaders.com. It has the core leadership skills that any of your managers and leaders need to learn. It's how we scaled College Pro Painters. It's how we built Gerber Auto Collision. It's how we built 1-800-GOT-JUNK. It's the core skills that I brought into each of those businesses. And I kind of give that content away. So it's all there. Irresponsible not to sign up your people there.
Say more about it. Invest in your leader. Sorry, can you just repeat the URL? Was it investinyourleaders.com?
Yeah, investinyourleaders.com. So every manager and leader, let's say you're running a construction company. We tend to talk to them about construction and, you know, marketing and sales and construction and all of our CRMs and all of our tools, but we don't teach them about coaching, about delegation, about time management, about interviewing, about running meetings, about running one-on-one meetings, about managing conflict, about applying situational leadership. So I give you the 12 core skills that anyone managing people needs to be good at. And if they're good at that, that's how they scale. These are the systems that I taught Kimball Musk, Elon's brother, back in 1993 when he worked for me. It's also the skills that I taught Peter Reeve, his cousin, who went on to build SolarCity. These are the core leadership skills that I don't really cover in my books. These are the ones that CEOs pay me big bucks to coach them on. But I packaged it up in a course to grow these entrepreneurial companies.
That's awesome. Okay, we will link that. I'm going to go check it out, and I would highly recommend our listeners do that as well, because I love that whole idea. There's a whole other side to the coin. You can know as much as you can know about construction or painting or landscaping or whatever, but to truly have high performance, it is this whole other secondary tool belt that you need to get into. Cameron, you've said it all, my friend. Really appreciate you coming on the show. We'll see you next time.
Appreciate it, Benji. Have a great one. Thanks for having me.
Bye. Thanks so much for watching this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our channel, consider sharing this episode with another contractor who you think needs to hear it.
Paynet podcasts are produced by the Painting Contractors Association and are made possible by members and industry partners. To find out more about upcoming education opportunities or for more information about joining PCA, visit pcapainted.org.